Good morning, welcome back. Boker Tov. Okay, everybody has sheets? Get this out. Our destination today is a beautiful city, Bnei Brak. Everybody's got? Okay. Not far from Petah Tikva, not far from the coast, is a city that appears in Sefer Yehoshua. You see it on your map on the top right and on the top left. On the source page, the Pasuk tells us that in the section of Dan, which on your top left map, you'll see it's on the coastline. You see Shevet Dan on the left side. So on the map on the top right, you see to the east of Tel Aviv, to the west of Petah Tikva, right next to Ramat Gan, is Bnei Brak. So Bnei Brak, Yehud, Bnei Brak, and Gat Rimon are three cities in this area of Dan. The modern-day area of Bnei Brak, this modern-day city, was settled in 1924 by religious pioneers. It's the home of a very prominent yeshiva, the Ponovitch Yeshiva, as well as other yeshivas and great Torah scholars. According to a legend, it was an exceptionally beautiful city in Israel. In the Yari collection of the Agadot, he describes a story. Now, I looked for this story in the Bar Ilan. I tried to do a search to find if it appears in other sources, but I didn't find. The story goes that Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi went to see a man who lived in Bnei Brak. His name was Rabbi Preda. And Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, so he's living in the 3rd century, and he says to Rabbi Preda, I'd love to see the neighborhood. You know, it's like sometimes people come visit us, they say, want to take us around Chicago, and we want to see the neighborhood. So Rabbi Preda says, I'll take you around the neighborhood. Let me show you. I have a backyard here. And Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi says, can you show me the vineyard that you have? Because apparently it was well known that this area, and even today, Petah Tikva, as many of you know, was an early settlement. This area is very suitable for agricultural development. So apparently Rabbi Preda takes Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi to the backyard to show him his vineyard. And he says, take a look. So Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi says, wait a second, that looks like an ox over there in the distance. It looks like a shore. And Rabbi Preda says, that's not an ox. That's a cluster of grapes. And Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi says, that's unbelievable. That the land is so beautiful, it's so bountiful here in Bnei Brak, where you live, Rabbi Preda, that what I thought was an animal is the size of a cluster of grapes. So this place, Bnei Brak, is very beautiful and it's very ancient. But what we're going to focus on today and what we're going to explore is a specific person who is associated with Bnei Brak. And what I wanted to understand is why this person is associated with Bnei Brak. That's the goal. Now, to suggest something, we're going to say today what we call in Yiddish, in Hebrew, in the world of learning, we call it a chiddush. A chiddush is something that is a suggestion, maybe it's something that's innovative. Now, I do this at my own peril because Rav Schwartz, should live and be well, once told us about what happens with chiddushim. Every year when he was well, we would bring all the Kollel fellows to the CRC and he would greet us. And he would always tell us the same story. He would tell us what it was like being yeshiva bachrim our age, or what I was like when I came here, a little younger than that. He was in the first kollel ever in Reitz in 1949, 1950. He would tell us how he got a bechina. I can't even imagine what this was like. In the same room, they had three giants of the generation. It was Rav Soloveitchik, it was Dr. Belkin, and Rav Moshe Shatzkitz, Zecher Tzadik Levracha, Zichronim Levracha. So they gave an oral exam. When I got smicha, it was a written exam. No one had to look me in the eye. So he described us what his smicha bechina was like. And then after he got smicha, he went to the first kollel. So he described to us that at the first meeting, they had a group of students, young men, sitting around the table with Dr. Belkin, Rav Soloveitchik, and Rav Zipperstein, Zichron Levracha, who was the founding Rosh Kollel of this Kollel with Rav Soloveitchik wasn't officially the Rosh Kollel. So apparently, at the meeting, Rav Soloveitchik asked the boys, what is the purpose of a Kollel? So Rav Schwartz told us that he raised his hand. He was the first boy to raise his hand. He raised his hand and he said to the Rav in Yiddish that the purpose of a kollel and fellows learning, in Yiddish he said to him, is to be machadish chidushim, to come up with new insights into learning. Apparently, at hearing that suggestion, Rav Soloveitchik began screaming, machadish chidushim! He thought it was the craziest thing ever. You don't learn to innovate. You clarify what the Rishonim said, and that's it. He thought it was crazy. Schwartz said it was so embarrassing. He said it was horrifying. He also pointed out, which was true, of course, is that whenever Rav Soloveitchik clarified the Rishonim, it was often a chiddush. But that wasn't the goal. So we try not to say chidushim. We're going to suggest something, and if the shoe fits, wear it. If you think it works, good. If not, we're going to have to keep figuring out the mystery. Because who is the man who is associated with this city, Bnei Brak? That's right. That comes from the Gemara that you see in source number 2, which is in Sanhedrin 32b, Lamed Beis, Lamed Beis. Tzedek, Tzedek Tirdof, the Gemara says, quotes a pasuk. What does it mean? You should be Rodef Tzedek. It means you should go after the greatest rabbis, the greatest of most authoritative, most knowledgeable rabbinic court. Where are you going to find these people? So each of them, they were people. They lived in places. So the Gemara tells us, Halech achar chachamim li yeshiva. Follow the chacham to his yeshiva, to his place. Achar Rabbi Eliezer, where did he live? Where did he go? Lud. So you want to find Rabbi Eliezer? You go to Lud. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai? You go to Bror Chayil. You want to find Rabbi Yoshua? You go, where did he have a base medrash? In Pekin. Pekin is a tiny town in the north of Israel, not far from Tzfat. Acha Rabbi Gamliel? Where would you go to find Rabbi Gamliel, who was the Nasi? Yavne. Yavne was the seat of the most senior rabbinic court after they moved from Yerushalayim. Acha Rabbi Akiva leBnei Brak. You follow Rabbi Akiva, you go to Bnei Brak. Why? This is what's bothering us. Why? It can't be accidental. It can't just be that Rabbi Akiva would be associated with and rooted in and connected to Bnei Brak just because. There has to be a reason. Rabbi Akiva's home in Bnei Brak was an important destination. When do we find that people went to Rabbi Akiva in Bnei Brak? What's that? That's right. That's what you see in source number 3. Maisa, the famous story between the five rabbis sitting at the table. Rabbi Eliezer, Rabbi Yeshua, Rabbi Eliezer ben Azariah, Rabbi Akiva, and Rabbi Tarfon, Shoyu Besuma ben Bnei Brak. They were sitting in Bnei Brak, and they were talking about Yetzias Mitzrayim all night, until their students came and said, Rabbi Seinu Igias Ma'akriya Shema Shol Shachris. So one of the commentaries on the Haggadah points out that how was Rabbi Akiva able to lean in Bnei Brak? How was he Mesubin? Who was at the table? Rabbi Akiva was a student of several great Tanaim, of great sages of his generation. two of whom were Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yeshua. Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yeshua, they were common interlocutors. They oftentimes got into disagreements. They had a lot of disagreements because they had different paths in learning. They had different learning styles, and Rabbi Akiva synthesized two of them. But there is a rule that if you're a Talmud, a student, in the presence of your Rebbe at the Seder, you can't lean. You can't demonstrate chayrus, leaning, especially in those times. You would sit back, they would sit on a couch, and you would put your feet up. You can't just put your feet up and lean. You lean on something. It's very disrespectful. So how could Rabbi Akiva lean in the presence of Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yeshua? So many commentaries point out, you know why? Because Rabbi Akiva was the Balabayas. Because it was his house. So in your own house, you're allowed to lean in the presence of your Rebbe. Because it's not disrespect, it's your house. That's how you sit in your house. So the sages understood that going to Bnei Brak was a big deal. So this too, did we ever think about at the Seder why they went to Bnei Brak? What was it about Bnei Brak that they had to go to Rabbi Akiva's house? What? Rabbi Tarfon, didn't have enough paper goods? What? Bnei Brak, the weather was so much better than it was in Pekin. A lot of people in Pesach, they like to go to the north. No, they could have gone to Pekin. It was probably beautiful in Rabbi Yeshua's Seder. But no, they went to Rabbi Akiva and Bnei Brak. They must have gone there for a reason. So what's the pshat? So there is a story that I suspect is known to almost everyone in this room. And that is that Rabbi Akiva did not grow up in, I would say, in the style of a sage, you could argue. Right? Rabbi Akiva was well known to be an ignoramus. So much so that when he met, there's a lot of discussion. There's a ton of discussion about Rabbi Akiva's life. For those who are interested more from a biographical and development standpoint in terms of his learning, Rabbi Bini Lau has a book called The Sages, which has a big section in the second volume, I think, on Rabbi Akiva. There's a ton of scholarship on Rabbi Akiva. There's also an article that I'll bring to your attention. His memory should be for a blessing, from Rav Eitam Henkin, Hashem Yikom Domo, the Talmud Chacham, the young Talmud Chacham who was murdered, what was it, 2 years ago, 3 years ago, driving in his car with his family. He and his wife were murdered. They were gunned down. He was a very prolific author. He wrote several svarim and many articles. So one of the articles that he wrote before he was murdered was on the life of Rabbi Akiva. And he takes all the different Gemaras and he puts them together to develop the timeline of Rabbi Akiva's life. You can find it online. You Google Eitam Henkin, Rabbi Akiva. They'll find you. There's a website called Asif that collects these articles. It's in Hebrew. There's a lot of material on Rabbi Akiva. But Rabbi Akiva at least had one wife. He possibly had more. But there was a wealthy man in Yerushalayim. His name was Kalba Savua. And Kalba Savua had a daughter. And she met Rabbi Akiva. And Kalba Savua said, you can't have anything to do with this guy. He's a total zero. Mamish, a total zero. And the Gemara says that Rabbi Akiva, when he was younger, he used to say, Tainli Talmud Chacham, give me a Talmud Chacham, ve'anashchenu, and I will bite him like a donkey. So Tosfos and Ksubas worries, how could it be that Ben Kalba Savua's daughter saw him and thought that he was a nice guy with Derech Eretz and Midas Tovos if he said he was going to bite the rabbis? So Tosfos says, well, the rabbis got him upset because of the way that they related to other people, and really he was nice, really had midos, but that was just Tosfos is very bothered by this. How could it be that she wanted to date this guy who said he was going to bite the rabbis? Rabbi Akiva was not very knowledgeable, right? According to the tradition, he was 40 years old until he became inspired to learn. What inspired Rabbi Akiva to learn? What's that?
Water.
The story with the water. Great. So what I'd like to do is I'd like to look at the story with you. There are two versions of the story, but this is the most common version of the story. What we have is a parallel to Pirkei Avos called Avos to Reb Nosson. And I want to look at the story carefully with you, and I want you to tell me if this makes sense. Because I never looked at it carefully. Amru, source number four, they said, Ben Arboim Shana Haya, Rabbi Akiva was 40 years old, Velo Shana Klum. He didn't learn anything. Pam Achas, one time, Haya Omeid Al Pi HaBe'er. He was standing on top of a well, or next to a well. Omar, he says, Michokak Evenzu, who hewed out this stone? I guess it was the brook that was coming out of the thing, or the stones at the edge of the well. They were smooth, like when you go on a tiyul, you see, right? The stones are smooth from the water. He says, who did that? Amru, they said, Lo hamayim shetodir noflin aleha b'chol yom. Isn't it the water that eroded the stone? Right? You ever go on a water hike? Or you go, I don't know, whitewater rafting or something like that? You see, you could have a cleft in a rock which is really carved out. And how is it carved out? Amru, they said to him, Lo amayim shetodir noflin, because it says in the pasuk, Amru lo, Akiva, iatokore avanim shachakumayim. The stones are smoothed out by the water. Miyad, immediately, Haya Rabbi Akiva done kal v'chomer be'atzmo. He learned a kal v'chomer be'atzmo in himself. Can someone tell me what is a kal v'chomer? That what? Yes. Great. So, what's an example of a kal v'chomer? A standard kal v'chomer. Forget Rabbi Akiva for a second. What would be? Yeah. Yeah. So the word kal means light. Chomer means severe. I think in Latin they call this an a fortiori.
Yeah.
Okay. It means if something is true on a severe, then certainly for the light. So, for example, let's say someone is a marathon runner. And they come back and they said, this morning I ran 17 miles. Someone walks in the door and they see a guy, you know, with one of those running bands and the very interesting size shorts and the shirt, the whole thing. And they say to him, they say to me, you see that guy? He looks like a runner. I say, yeah, he is. He says to me, do you think he could run 5 miles? So do I think he can run 5 miles?
Sure. Yeah.
If he told me this morning he can run 17 miles, kal v'chomer, he can run 5 miles. That is a classic kal v'chomer, right? Kal v'chomer. I'm telling you that I could lift a weight that's 200 pounds. So if you ask me about 100 pounds, kal v'chomer, for sure. This is a classic, what we call a midah shatorah nidreshes b'hem. One of the ways of interpreting the Chumash, the rabbis have tools. For example, we have 13 of them in Rabbi Yishmael. Rabbi Yishmael had a tradition of 13 tools at the end of Karbanos. You say in the morning, what's the first of the, I think it's the first one, right? Rabbi Yishmael, first one is Kal V'chomer. Another one is called Binyan Av, where you compare two things. You have two people sitting next to each other. This one and that one. Well, they're kind of similar in certain ways, so you compare them. So Kal V'chomer is a classic Talmudic way of learning Chumash. You take a principle, and you could derive the obvious inference from that. So Rabbi Akiva is going to draw a Kal V'chomer from this understanding. What is the Kal V'chomer? Ma rach posal es hakosha. What about something which is soft, is able to, what does the word lift soul mean? Posel, like psol lachosh ne luchot avanim? It's to, that's right, to engrave. So just like something which is soft, which in this case is water, can engrave something which is hard, a stone. Divrei Torah, words of Torah, shekasha kabarzel, that are hard like iron, al achas v'kama v'kama, certainly sheyechakku eslibi shehu basar v'dam, they will certainly cut into my heart, which is flesh. And therefore, miyad chazar lilmod Torah. Now here's my question. Is this actually a Kal V'chomer?
No, because it goes from the light to the heart.
Okay. In a certain sense, it's going from light to heart, but in this case, it's going from
heart to heart.
It's going from, if something, let's say, if a 5-pound weight or if a paper airplane can break your window, so certainly a stone can break your window. But here's the thing that I don't understand. Is this really a Kal V'chomer? Because what was the big einfall for Rabbi Akiva? A Kal V'chomer is usually, or you would have thought in Yiddish, you would say an einfall. What was the great revelation? What did he figure out? What hit him right now? Had he never had meat before? The chiddush of this is that water can make a dent in a rock, right? So he says, oh, if water can make a dent in a rock, then an iron knife, spear, can cut through meat, can cut through the flesh of my heart, right? What does that have to do with each other? Right? That's not a chiddush. Didn't you know that before? Right? That's what I don't understand about this story. Rabbi Lau points this out in the piece that he has on Rabbi Akiva. Now, he doesn't answer this question exactly. He moves on to a different thing. But wait a second. Are you with me on this? The story doesn't make sense 100% the way that it's written.
But because I think we are looking cachet in the sense of strong, like I...
Okay.
Cachet in this case are not something that is very strong. It's just something that is very deep.
Okay. Shoshana, so explain to me what you're saying.
It is, the words of Torah are not like a stone. They are something that one has to process. And so they are very quiet. But when one processes them, then they become very powerful.
Okay. Okay. So tell me if I'm onto what you're saying here. Even though Rabbi Akiva is telling us that Divrei Torah are like iron, which would have been obvious to us that can cut through meat. Everybody cuts through meat with a stone. The Chiddush for Rabbi Akiva was that even something which is soft like water, if you're consistent and persistent, it can also make a difference. Yeah?
Foreshadowing of himself.
Yes, that what? Right? For sure, that's what the Gemara is trying to tell you, yes?
So it's that he is like the water, and the Divrei Torah is like the stone, and if he is persistent enough, he can actually make a difference in his life.
Okay.
Or you can flip it.
That what?
Or you can flip it, that he's like the rock, that he's never been touched by anything, that he's hard, and over time, if he's persistent with learning, and the Torah is like Maim Chaim, right?
I was just going to say, is the Torah like water?
Well, it is.
It sure is. Yeah. Okay.
So it's Maim Chaim, so that therefore, as much as he's persistent in learning Torah, it will have a dent in his life and it will change him.
Oh. So I think between the two of you, we could suggest this could be perhaps our Chiddush in understanding the story, which is maybe what Rabbi Akiva is learning from this story and the way to kind of finesse this Kal V'chomer is the following. Rabbi Akiva says, look, I learned from this stone something very important. That is that if you take something like water, you can have an impact. Perhaps if you took iron and tried to cut into a stone, you would not be successful. But if you take water and pour it over a stone persistently, you could be successful. So maybe the way to read this story, at least homiletically, is Rabbi Akiva saying, wait a second. I grew up with one perspective on learning. And that's why I hated it. Because I thought that learning was hitting people with iron. And I didn't like that. It didn't work. It didn't open my heart. That's the question he's saying. He's saying, I don't understand. If water can hew through a rock, so certainly iron, which is Divrei Torah, should get through to my heart. That's what he's saying in the Kal Vachomer. And what's the answer? The answer is that's not true. Because if Divrei Torah is like iron, it may not cut through your heart. So what did Rabbi Akiva learn? Not anything about iron, but rather he learned something about water. And in that moment, he realized that if his heart is like stone or is impenetrable from iron, that's only because the Torah is like iron. But if the Torah is like water and it's gentle and it's persistent and it's soft, then maybe even somebody like me, maybe I can learn. So he goes to learn Torah. Maybe the shift is that Rabbi Akiva sees the water can make a dent and realizes that what he needs is an approach to Torah which is based in mayim, in water. Now, that doesn't mean there isn't a place and an important aspect of seriousness and accountability and responsibility when it comes to learning. But if learning is all about beating people with iron, then young men and maybe young women like Rabbi Akiva, some of them, they just might not make it. So I'll tell you one maisa. Nechama's grandfather, Zichrona Levracha, Rabbi Alexander Sender Gross, Zichus Yagan Aleinu, he was a master mechanich. He was an unbelievable educator. We've talked about him before, he went all over America, Israel, Iran, setting up schools in the 40s and 50s with the founding Torah Mesorah, Reb Shraga Feivelman, the loved Secher Tzadik Levracha. But because of his ill health, he ended up in Florida. So he had to stay, that's where he stayed in Miami until he died at a very young age. He always had persistent health challenges. So when he was a little boy, when they left Europe, they lived in a shtetl in Czechoslovakia. So they were leaving the shtetl, they were on a wagon, his father's name was Menashe, they had, I think, 8 siblings. He was one of the younger ones. So as the wagon was leaving, they're rolling out of town, he says to his father, I just need 1 minute, I have to run back for one thing. He gets off the wagon, he runs back into the shtetl, and then he comes running back, he gets on the wagon, says, let's go, right now. So they start driving away, and he sees, his father sees in the distance, coming out of the shtetl, is the Malamed. And he's cursing at them. And he's holding a broken stick. Because the last thing that he did in Europe as a 9-year-old boy was to tell the Malamed that you don't educate children with sticks. So he came to America and he had a filing cabinet that people found after he went to the other world. His final decline was because there was a problem with the bus drivers and they wouldn't drive the buses. They had some kind of strike or something. So he went to drive the bus. Rabbi Gross, the tremendous Talmud Chacham, he went to drive the bus and he had his last heart attack getting onto the bus. He collapsed. So he had a file when after he died, they went to the office, they found a filing cabinet with a file in the back called Mein Kind. It was all the children who he snuck past the board members to get into the school so that they should have a Jewish education. But what kind of Jewish education? One that was beloved and sweet and welcoming. Because he understood that not all children are gonna learn Torah if you hit them with barzel, if you hit them with iron. For some it worked. For Rabbi Gamliel and some of his Talmidim, it worked. But Rabbi Akiva didn't work for him. Didn't work. So Rabbi Akiva says, I have to go learn. Where did Rabbi Akiva learn? Now we're going to start to put together some of the pieces, and you'll tell me if this Chiddush could possibly, as they would say in Yiddish, is Ois Gehalten. Where did Rabbi Akiva learn? Who was his Rebbe? We mentioned his Rebbe was Rabbi Elazar and Rabbi Yeshua, but he also had another Rebbe who was somewhat unusual and was distinct to Rabbi Akiva. Says the Gemara in Chagiga, Daf Yud Beis, Shal Rabbi Yishmael es Rabbi Akiva, K'shahoyu medlalchem bederech. Source number 5. Rabbi Yishmael, he said to Rabbi Akiva, they were usually interlocutors. If you go through Shas, who argue the most, Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Yishmael? They have two totally different ways of looking at learning. Not for today. Amale, ata sheshimashta es nachum ish gamzu. Esther and Vishtaim Shana. You were a student for 22 years of who? A man by the name of Nachum Ish Gamzu. What was Nachum Ish Gamzu very famous for saying? Gamzu Latova. Rabbi Akiva said, I'm going to find a Rebbe who's going to see everything positive. So Gemara tells a story in Brachos that Rabbi Akiva came to a town and it's like a joke. He comes to the town, he has a chicken and a candle, and he's looking for, but he doesn't have a place to sleep. So he shows up to the town. Nobody will give him a place to sleep. Rabbi Akiva, no one will give him a place to sleep. So he goes out to the forest nearby, so he's going to sleep in the forest, the Seder. So a fox comes and eats the chicken, and the wind comes and blows out the candle. So what does Rabbi Akiva say? He says, I had a Rebbe. My Rebbe says, Gamzu Latova. It's Beseder. Think positive. Be positive. He wakes up in the morning. He goes nearby the town, and he sees that overnight, the bandits who were coming down the highway to ransack somebody found this town and pillaged it completely and murdered all the people in the town, stealing all of their stuff. So Rabbi Akiva looks and says, Gamzu Latova. If I had a chicken, they would have heard me. They would have found me. If I had a candle, they would have seen me. If I would have had a place to sleep, I've been dead. Gamzu Latova. Rabbi Akiva, it's not an accident that he went to learn by Nachum Ish Gamzu. He went to learn by Nachum Ish Gamzu because he needed a role model of someone who would say, it's positive, it's sweet, it's soft. He goes to Nachum Ish Gamzu, and he becomes the personification of Torah as Mayim which quenches the thirst, which puts out the fire. It extinguishes the harshness, and it brings people positivity. What does the Gemara tell us in the end of Makos? Turn the page. Tells us a couple of stories where Shuv, this is the second one, I think, second or third. Pamachas only Yerushalayim. They were walking, Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Tarfa and others, they were walking to Yerushalayim. Came in Shigil Arat Sofim, when they came to Mount Scopus, Karu Big Dam, they tore their clothes, came in because the Beis Mikdash had been destroyed. Came in Shigil Arabayas Ro, Shuol, Sheyatsim in Beis Kodesh HaKadoshim. They saw a fox that was going out of the Kodesh HaKadoshim, of the holiest of the holy. Hischilu Hein Bochin, they started to cry. Rabbi Akiva Mitzachek. But Rabbi Akiva was laughing. He says, you guys, you're so down, you're so negative, you're so harsh. Smile. Try to find the bright side of this. You know there's a nevuah of destruction, but that same prophet, that same book, that same canon of Tanakh, it has lots of prophecies of consolation. So don't look at it from the harsh standpoint, from the barzel. Look at it from the mayim. Look at it from the positive. Why did the rabbis go to Bnei Brak? So one tradition is they went to Bnei Brak because this is, Rabbi Akiva was associated with the Bar Kokhba rebellion. The Rambam points out, like the Talmud Yerushalmi says, that Rabbi Akiva thought that Bar Kokhba was a quasi form of Mashiach, that he was going to salvage the Jewish nation. It didn't work out at all. But Rabbi Akiva thought that, which also ties into this, but not al pi pshat. So some suggest that the reason why the rabbis went to Rabbi Akiva because they were having a clandestine meeting about revolt. And that the Talmidim who came in the morning to tell them, rabbis, it's time to say Shema, that was a code word for saying, this conversation has to be over because the walls have ears and people are coming around. It was a nighttime conversation only. That's one tradition, which is interesting. But the other way to look at it is that Rabbi Akiva is living in the post-Beis HaMikdash era. What is the Seder like after the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash? It's so depressing. Yes, there's Chag Gadyah. And yes, we have like plastic frogs. We can still do plastic frogs, even though the Beis HaMikdash is destroyed. And we can still sing the same songs. But it's not really Pesach. Pesach is the Korban Pesach. Yerushalayim is over. There's no Beis HaMikdash. There's no Korbanos. What kind of a Yontif is this? So the rabbis are all looking at each other saying, where are we going to go to have a nice Pesach? What, we're going to go to Rabbi Yeshua? We're all going to sit around the table crying. We're going to be so despondent. We need to go somewhere where somebody has some chizuk, something positive, some way to look at it that even though it's broken outside, but we're going to be positive. We're going to bring a fresh, positive perspective. So you say, you know what? I don't know if Rabbi Akiva has any room, but we're all going to his house. We're all going to Rabbi Akiva. Because in the time of Golus, hitting people with Barzel, it's not good. They need a pick-me-up. Where is Rabbi Akiva going to settle? Where is he going to find a place that is going to embody, that's going to be in sync with his perspective of looking at the sweet side of life, the positive side of life? Well, there is actually one story in the Gemara about Bnei Brak. It might not be the only story, but it's one of the few stories in the Gemara. I can't say authoritatively because I haven't learned all of Shas yet. We're all on a journey, and I didn't check the Bar Ilan for every place where it says Bnei Brak, but this is one of the only stories. There might be more, but this is the most prominent one. Look at the Gemara number 7. Rami Bar Yecheskel, who was one of the sages, Ikhla le Bnei Brak. This is the Gemara. If you research Bnei Brak, that everybody quotes, because this is the one story about Bnei Brak in the Gemara. What did he see? Chazinu lahani izi. He saw these goats, da'achlan tusi te'eni, that the goats were noshing under a date tree. I studied in Yeshiva in Israel, which in Keren Biavna, which is kind of on the coast. It's a beautiful temperate area, so they had date palms all over the place. It's not uncommon in Israel, you have date palms all over the place. So they had goats that were noshing under date trees. And says the Gemara, v'konotif duvsha mite'eni, and there was honey that was dripping from the te'enim. When we say that the Pasuk says that Eretz Yisrael is praised for 7 things, Eretz zeh shemen u'divash, that's not referring to bee honey, although you can get bee honey in Israel. What is it referring to? Date honey, right? We know that. So the date honey is dripping down from this date palm. You can all imagine this in Israel, big clusters of dates. They're probably overripe, so they're dripping. It's probably the summertime. So the dates, what's that?
It's figs.
I'm sorry, figs, right. Figs, sorry. Right. The best way to, I don't know any women named Te'ina. The best way to remember this is that you can take a woman on a date if her name is Tamar, but usually you don't find anyone whose name is Te'ina. So that's the way to remember that the date goes with Tamar, the Te'ina goes with the fig. That's the easiest. Al regalachas. There today in Israel, there probably are women who are named Te'ina, but I don't know any. I know lots of Tamars, not too many Te'inas. That's just the way to. Sorry, the figs. The fig trees, which we also see in Israel. Got it. V'chal b'tayef minayu. And there's milk flowing from the goats, which is also a thing that probably in the Tanakh, when they're referring to the Zavas Chol V'Dvash, it's exactly as Gemara says. There are lots of goats in Israel, not so many cows. There are plenty of cows, but not so many. Uma'arav b'hadi hadadi. So here it is in Bnei Brak, where the fig juice, the fig honey is flowing, and the milk is flowing. Omar said, Rami Bar Yecheskel, Hainu Zavas Chol V'Dvash. This is Zavas Chol V'Dvash. This is a land flowing with milk and honey. Where was it? in Bnei Brak. Well, chalav and dvash are both very sweet. They also represent something that's very sweet. Chalav is white. That represents the midah of chesed from Hashem. The positive. When you eat milk, you can make a commercial. No behemoths have been harmed in the process of this milk. That's why some explain, al pidin, we're allowed to eat meat. That's part of the story of Bereshis and Noach. We're allowed to eat meat, but some suggest that part of the issue of basar b'chalav is that you should not confuse the thing. When you eat meat, some behema had to make the ultimate sacrifice in empire for our Shabbos meal, which is good. Nothing taking away from that. There's a mitzvah to eat basar shlamim. But you should not confuse eating meat, which some animal had to die for, with eating milk, drinking milk, which the animal, you know, will gladly share with you, at least if you're friendly. So chalav is sweetness. Milk is very sweet. That's why, if you have small children, the dentist will tell you, do not leave them with cups of milk in their bed, because what will happen after a while? No teeth left. Baby, they're going to need dentures, three-year-old dentures, because the milk is full of sugar. So chalav is sweet, and dvash avada is sweet. The fig juice is, of course, is sweet. Figs are very sweet. So in Bnei Brak, it's the place of sweetness. What is nimshal, is compared to chalav and dvash? Says the Medrash in Shira Shirim, source number 8. I have a havamina. Shemen, oil, is the symbol of wisdom. So maybe uma shemen, wisdom of oil, is mar mitchiloso, it's bitter. Oil is initially bitter. And then besofo, umasak besofo, after you crush it, then it takes a little bit sweeter. Yachal af divrei Torah kein. Maybe divrei Torah have to start out bitter. And you have to crush it with iron. And then afterwards it'll be sweet. Says the Medrash, not true. You don't have to look at divrei Torah like that. Talmud lomar, dvash, v'cholav. Ma heim mesukim, just like dvash and cholav are masuk. What else is masuk? Dalid tuf. What's dalid tuf? Af dalid tuf? That's right, divrei Torah. Divrei Torah are compared to dvash and cholav. That's a pasuk in Shira Shirim. Dvash v'cholav tachas l'shonech. And this is elsewhere in the Midrashim. So that's why the Medrash says, Shenemar mesukim midvash. Torah is as sweet as honey. Imad vash yeshbo ktsarim yachal after v'torakein. Well, is it exactly like honey? Because sometimes honey has little pieces of bees stuck in it. Tamalomar chalav, ma chalav naki, just like milk is pure. Assuming there's no hairs that fell in there. My great aunt, I still remember on the farm, my great uncle and aunt, Aleihem HaShalom, they had a farm near Scranton, the family farm. So we went as children. We used to see my great aunt milk the cows, and then she would skim off whatever was, you know. So the milk, the Medrash is saying, is naki after v'torah nikiyim. So too, umachal of tofel, yochal after v'torah tofel, tamad lomar, dvash v'cholav. When they're mixed together, ein mezikin laguf, haguf, last line of the Medrash. Milk and honey, they don't hurt the body. They're natural sweeteners. There's a fellow who I know, he needs a refuah shlema. Imamish needs a refuah shlema. So he's gone to all different kinds of physicians and doctors and different kinds of doctors. And one of the things that they're telling him is that he has to be very sensitive about his diet because he's very ill, low lane. He needs a refuah shlema. So one of the things that he told me, he said that he doesn't take processed sugar anymore. He takes dates or figs or something like that and he puts it in his tea, squeezes it out. This is sweet, and it's ein mazik laguf. This is natural. It's very healthy. Says the Medrash, kach divrei Torah. That's the pshat with divrei Torah. So now, it makes perfect sense. Rabbi Akiva says, I want to find Torah that's like mayim, that's like dvash and cholov. That's sweet, that's positive, that's beautiful, that's uplifting. So where am I going to go? I'm going to go to Bnei Brak. Bnei Brak is the place that expresses the Zavas Chol V'Dvash of the land of Israel in the context of Torah. So of course, B'nai Brak is going to be a center for Torah learning. Now, if we had more time, you could think of it on even on deeper levels, the fact that Rabbi Akiva wasn't just learning the standard, I guess you would call it the Nigla, the revealed parts of Torah, he was learning the Nister. Rabbi Akiva had a student, his name was Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, who was Megala to us, the secrets of Torah, the mystical insights of Torah. Rabbi Akiva was Doresh, he darshaned, he learned all the crowns, the Tagin, the things that even Moshe Rabbeinu couldn't understand, the Gemara says. Rabbi Akiva is in the oral tradition, which is also has an added measure of sweetness. But that's for a longer discussion. But the idea is, perhaps, that the reason why Rabbi Akiva and B'nai Brak fit together is because B'nai Brak is associated with Zavas Chol V'Dvash, and Torah is referred to as Zavas Chol V'Dvash, and those are sweet experiences. And that was what Rabbi Akiva was looking for, that he realized when he saw the water, to move away from the model of the Barzel toward the model of sweetness. Yes?
This past week in Israel, a great Torah sage died.
Yes, Rav Nissen Karelitz. In the front
pages of the Jerusalem Post,
yes,
there was a picture of the 18,000 people that attended his funeral, and there was a very lengthy article about all the dynasties, including the one that Rabbi Karelitz comes from, and I don't remember which one.
He was related to the Chazon Ish.
his mother was the sister of the Chazon.
That's right, exactly.
But there was this big article on the front page of the Jerusalem Post as to all the different rabbis from the dynasties that survived. They wanted to settle in
B'nai Brak.
This week was the funeral of the Gaon Rabbi Karelitz.
That's right.
That 18,000 people came to the funeral.
Right, it's not coincidental that after the war, well, during the war already, the Rav Kahaneman, the Ponovitch Rav, when he ran away from the Nazis, where did he decide to build? It was Hashgacha, that God put him to rebuild in B'nai Brak. And like you said, with many, the Chazon Ish had already been there before the war, the Chazon Ish settled in B'nai Brak. And for many, many generations, this was the thing. If you look in the, in the Vilnai guide, I'll get you in 1 second, he points out that for a long time, this was associated with Torah learning in the Vilnai Guide to Israel. Yeah, what were we going to say?
But conversely, in the yes. same article, it says that B'nai Brak is one of the poorest cities in Israel, and the government is working with it a lot because it's considered one of the very poorest cities in all of Israel.
So we have to be mechazik that. It's interesting that it's not far from Petah Tikva, which is in that area, theoretically, could be agriculturally one that's prosperous. Yeah, Glenn, what are we going to say?
Often you'll spend some time explaining that the name has some significance.
Is yeah. there any... So I don't know. Maybe everybody could think about that at some point this week. I was racking my brain. I did not find a lot of discussion about the name, the Tanakh name, B'nai Brak. The word Barak means a lightning bolt. So if you want to say like a homily that Rabbi Akiva, he was hit by a lightning bolt to have this transformation. But I don't know. You have to... There's also more to say about this in a different vein, because the Gemara does say that there's a tradition that Rabbi Akiva was descended from converts. There is also a tradition, the Gemara says in Gittin, that the descendants of Haman taught Torah in B'nai Brak. Many B'nai Banav Shal Haman limdu Torah b'B'nai Brak. Lamdu or limdu, they either taught or they learned. So that's also, I think it relates to the fact that it was in Sheva Dan. But I wanted to close this out with one maybe last loop, based on the legend from Rav Yari, from Rav Avram Yari. We said, according to the legend, that B'nai Brak was beautiful and it was agriculturally developed, specifically in the area of Eshkolot, of vineyards. So there is a Mishnah in Maseches Sota. Look at number 9. Mishemes Yosi ben Yoezer ish Tzreda. From the time that Yosi ben Yoezer, the man of Tzreda, and Yosef ben Yochanan ish Yerushalayim, when these two rabbis, they were zugos, they were pairs, meaning the chief rabbi and the assistant chief rabbi, they served as pairs, right, in the times of the Mishnah. It's in Pirkei Avos, they're mentioned together. The Mishnah says at the end of Sota, when they died, batlu ho eshkolos. What is an eshkol? A cluster of grapes. An eshkol is a cluster. It means somebody who's well-rounded, who has everything. They have all kinds of knowledge. They're multidimensional, multifaceted. So when they died, there were no more men who were that multidimensional. That's what the Mishnah says. Says the Talmud Yerushalmi, V'lo Amad Eshkol, Acha Amad Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva was the Eshkol, who generations later came to be a man who encompassed everything. Nikolad, the revealed Torah, and Nistar, and Drush, and Halacha, and everything. Rabbi Akiva, the Gemara is saying, was the Ishka Eshkolot. When Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, who lived, of course, later on, went to Rabbi Preda in Bnei Brak, what did he go outside? What did he find? Giant Eshkolot. Giant clusters of grapes. He found the Neshama of Rabbi Akiva. He found a Torah sage who was the Eshkol. When nobody else, when for generations the Eshkolos had been Batlu, they found Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva was the symbol of the Eshkol. What is an Eshkol? It's that grape. It's the yain. It's very sweet. When you eat grapes, it's so sugary, right? It also can rot your teeth. And if you're careful about sugar, they have a lot of inyanim about grapes with the diet. It's a dangerous thing. It's a lot of sugar. Rabbi Akiva was the Isha Eshkol. He was the Eshkol of Bnei Brak because he was the man who personified and exemplified the positive, sweet aspect of Torah. And even at the end of his life, so many sages, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, and this one and that one, so many sages, the end of their life, how did they end their life? They would cry, because I can imagine why. Lo aleinu, it's a scary thing. Rabbi Akiva ended his life at the hands of the Romans, being combed by iron combs. And what did he say? Ah, my whole life I waited for this. My whole life I waited to be able to be mekayem the mitzvah of ve'ahavta es Hashem Elokecha b'chol nafshecha. My love for Hashem, my positive, my sweetness, it never dims. And he even died in that perspective of sweetness, even in something that was so brutal. And how did they comb his body? With iron combs. Rabbi Akiva says, iron, it doesn't affect me anymore. I'm beyond that. I learned that it's all about being connected to the Ribbono Shel Olam, the Torah that's nimshal to mayim, the Torah that's nimshal to yayin, the Torah that's nimshal to zavas, cholov, and dvash. That sweetness, my connection with Hashem is so sweet that no iron from anyone, even the Romans who are literally going to be notalis nafsho, nobody can take away the sweetness of his relationship with Hashem and the sweetness of his Torah. Is it surprising then, that sweetness that totally revolutionized the entirety of Torah learning? From Bnei Brak, that's the sweetness. Have a great week.